This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay respects to elders past and present and acknowledge their ongoing connection to land, waters and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that continue to this day. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hello and welcome to AusPulse NACpod, the podcast where we bring you bite-sized chunks of Australian politics and news with a side of crispy memes, and the official podcast of the AusPulse Shitposting Facebook group. My name's Noon, also known as Ino Funkenstein, and I'm the admin and creator of AusPulse Shitposting, and with me is my co-host.
Hey, Zach the Snack. I'm just some guy, and we're back. We're back with our regular format. We had 2 weeks of interviews. Sorry, we didn't mean to kind of do that. It just sort of happened. We're going to try to be better organized with that in future and like let people know in advance maybe when that's going to be happening so that, you know, we don't take people by surprise.
Yeah. And we sort of wanted to interview both of those people for different reasons, and it just kind of cropped up that it was in the same couple of weeks. But we're looking forward to doing our being on our regular bullshit now. So
yeah, can get back on it. Should be a bit of a bumper episode. We've got
a busy couple of weeks.
Yeah. So Noon, you want to get stuck in? We've got a couple entrees this week.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like some spring rolls and some curry puffs.
Delicious.
You want to get into the first one?
Yeah. So this one is about John Setka, who we've talked about a few times, who's the secretary of the Victorian CFMMEU. Yeah. It's double M, not double F.
What does the second M stand for?
It's construction, forestry, mining,
maritime.
Yeah, because they combined with the Dockies Union, yeah, just recently. So John Setka, you probably all know about it. He was in court for domestic violence-related stuff and sending threats via carrier and all this other things, and he pled guilty to that, and the Labour Party have been trying to expel him from the Labour Party ever since, and everyone else has been trying to get him to resign from his job as leader of the CFMMEU in Victoria.
Including by threatening to vote for union-busting legislation.
Yeah, which,
shout out to everyone's favourite, extremely confusing politician.
Jackie Lambie. Yeah, and it looks like she is going to vote for that now. And it's going to get up even without her, so
yes,
it doesn't really matter,
sure.
But it still sucks. But the other person who sucks is John Setka. And
big time.
He was about to be expelled from the Labour Party on Friday and quit 2 days earlier on the Wednesday. And he did this like release about, you know, oh, it's this free trade agreement. The Labour Party have lost their souls under Anthony Albanese and they're selling out the workers and I can't abide this anymore and I'm taking a stand. It's weird to me that it was this particular free trade agreement, not the like dozens and dozens of others that the Labour Party have supported over the last few years.
You've got to respect the audacity to go with "you can't fire me, I quit."
Totally,
like,
yeah.
On that, yeah. At that scale.
No, I'm dumping you.
And I mean, here's the thing: he's a piece of shit,
uh-huh.
and he absolutely should leave the Labour Party and all other organizations of which he is a part. But also, he can still be right about the Labour Party being neoliberal hacks these days.
That is definitely true, yes. But anyway, I'm glad to see him out. And I think this has been one of the very few wins for Albanese since he's been in office.
Mm.
It's literally the only thing he's taken a stand about. And
Seth Kerr's like, you're folding for literally everything else that comes down the
just
pipeline.
Give me a break.
You're not going to fall for me too? What is this?
Yeah. So anyway, that's happened. It's good. I think I said a couple of weeks ago on the show that Setka is out already, and that was not the case. But he is now. So
yes.
Go listen to that episode again and
shake your
it's
head
true now.
In yeah. disappointment. Yeah. Express your disappointment out loud on the tram as you're listening to the podcast. Be like, Noon. God damn it, Noon.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, that's my entree. What do we got for the curry puffs? Our second entree.
Yeah, definitely not a pun at all related
to
this
just
story.
A tasty fried food.
Yes, which we all know and love. I just wanted to briefly talk about the fact that it's come to light that the Department of Social Services has been massively underreporting the amount of people on Newstart who are sick or disabled. So by quite a lot, roughly 80,000 people, which equates to like they were underreporting by about 40%. So right. Like it's almost like half again.
Yep.
The number of people that have been saying the people on Newstart who they have assessed as being only partially able to work, which means that they can work more than 15 hours a week, but less than 30. And there's a few reasons why this has happened. One is that there has been like a tightening of the conditions under which you're allowed to receive the disability support pension. And that has pushed a bunch of people into Newstart who would otherwise have been receiving the disability support pension. And like, you know, before those reforms were pushed through, disability advocates were extremely clear about that. The government went ahead and did it anyway. But it also has to do with the way that they have been reporting these figures. So basically, they've been only reporting people who have been assessed as being partially able to work within the last 2 years. If your assessment right. was made 2 years ago, they're like, oh, you know, this person hasn't been assessed as being partially able to work, so we'll just assume that they got a job, totally. Or that they're not on the, or that they're able to work full time, or that they're not sick or disabled anymore. So what this means is that there are, of the people on Newstart, there's about 40% of them that are sick or disabled. So
and most of those people should be eligible for disability support pension, which is significantly higher money and significantly less stress of like
you don't
being
have to go to job active
forced
appointments
to apply for bullshit jobs.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I guess a case of the government and the Department of Social Services in particular, like kicking people off payments in order to put them on this other payment where it's much easier for them to like cook the books.
Totally.
To kick them off that payment because it has more requirements. So this is just a further attack on the most marginalized people in our society, which is fucking awful. And it's also really similar to this other story that came up from Greens Senator Rachel Seward, and she was grilling the Department of Social Services in Senate estimates and was asking them about the number of people on job active on Newstart, where basically, you know, you have to go to X many job appointments or interviews.
Apply for 20 a month or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah I was on it years
It's different
ago.
For different people.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the numbers are. But they told her that 100,000 people have dropped out of the job active program, and the department just doesn't track them and assumes that they have found a job.
So those numbers are counted as in the like employed category, so even though presumably plenty of them are now like...
Well, a lot of them are like will have died or sure. are homeless.
Totally.
And they're like disproportionately Indigenous because fucking obviously.
Uh-huh.
But the department gets to like inflate the numbers that they claim have people have successfully found jobs through this stuff. So, yeah, I think basically this is just another case of the government
hating poor people.
Yeah, hating poor people, crunching the numbers on Newstart to make it look like it's much more effective than it is, and basically showing that any time that there's any opportunity for them to like quote unquote assume that somebody has like successfully passed through the program, that they just claim that as a win and move yep. on. So if you ever see statistics from the Department of Social Services, don't believe them.
Uh-huh.
That's
a good takeaway message.
That's the moral here.
Thanks for that, Zach. Now we've got a blurst take.
It was the best of
takes.
It was the blurst of
takes.
You stupid monkey.
Yeah, so we actually also had a blessed take, but I don't think it's going to fit in the show, so we're going to post that on our Facebook page, which maybe we should have set up top this week. We've actually created a Facebook page for this podcast.
Yeah, so basically if we make original content,
we can share it in groups other than AusBullshit posting.
Which is a closed group.
Yes.
Yeah. And for promotion, tell your friends.
Yeah, totally. So hop on there and like the page, but also check out this article that we'll post about... people working at Coles and Woolies.
Yeah, and that's just facebook.com/AusPollSnackPod.
Yep. That was going to be our blessed take, but we also have a blurst take, which is this amazing couple of tweets. So the first one is from Dave Graney, and he says, "Is there an Australian equivalent of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, charismatic, popular, young, left-wing politician / activist? Would they get the same airtime as the dolts we produce and cultivate so readily like Hanson and her goons?" That's a pretty good tweet. I'm for it. It's fine.
I posted something very similar recently, just seeing I don't know, AOC and also Bernie doing really good work in the Democratic primaries and being and actually feeling inspired by a thing that a politician says.
Totally.
Which is not...
a common experience.
Not a reflex that's been activated in this country for a long fucking time.
I think part of the issue is that the Democrat and Republican parties have a very different organizational structure than the Australian equivalents.
Massively so.
And so there's a lot more... Like, I mean, Bernie isn't really a Democrat. He's an independent who sits with them sometimes. Yeah. And so anyway, it's not really comparable. But it's a worthwhile question because, like, it shows that maybe some people could get into Parliament who weren't completely fucking useless.
Well, yeah. I mean, I do think it is relelevant to talk about why... We don't have
Australia
an AOC or a
yeah.
Bernie, and it is largely, I think, down to these kind of structural differences in the way that the parties operate and the way that the electoral systems operate. You get way more loose units in the states, and it's also a numbers game as well. They've got, twice, three times the amount of politicians that we do.
Sure.
But there was a response to that tweet, which is the, in fact, the blurst take.
Yeah, so this one comes from Matt Cooper. At Matt_Cooper EXSC.
Don't follow him.
Yeah, well, definitely not after this tweet, where he says, I would argue that Christina Keneally could fill that role. Sharp as a tack, of razor wit, doesn't take shit from men in suits. Ooh!
Mm. Oh. Yeah, really similar to AOC, who is famous for demonizing immigrants.
Uh-huh. American. That's kind of a similarity with AOC.
Is she?
Well, she has an American accent. Christina Keneally does. Yeah. I mean, yeah. No, well, she is extremely white. She's much older. And she was, like, deeply involved in the corrupt activity of the New South Wales Labour Party over the past, like, two or three decades.
Yeah, and has spent her entire time as Shadow Minister for Home Affairs trying to outflank our extremely racist government from the right on immigration.
Yeah.
Matt... What the fuck are you talking about? This is a blurst take.
Yep, agreed. All right. And Zach, what do we have up next?
So a little bit of First Nations news this week. So the big news is that the Uluru climb has finally been closed.
Finally.
This
is 32 years after the traditional owners at first asked for it to be closed, I'm fairly sure.
Fucked. Yeah, it's the closing of like a really depressing... chapter in the history of this quote-unquote country. So the local indigenous people are the Anangu. Uluru is sacred to them. They do not climb it. Climbing it is offensive. They have made it very clear that they don't want people climbing on this thing that's very important to them. There's been a lot of like comparisons of like, this would be like if people wanted to climb over the Australian War Memorial, which I don't think is a fucking helpful comparison,
no.
To be honest.
I think it's kind of useful in the sense that the people who are outraged that they can't climb Uluru are the same people who are just like wake up in the morning already saluting the soldiers.
Yeah, absolutely. So, they've got that framed photo of like the Rats of Tobruk with a little like replica pistol embedded in the
like
I'm talking
A1.
About someone very specific here. But well, they have one. They have it at A1. But I've seen a few of them around.
Sure. So in that sense, it's like, this is something that people could relate to being disrespectful, but it's on a completely different scale and it's a different sort of disrespect. And actually, this is something we didn't talk about in our show notes, but, fucking Scott Morrison this week saying that he wants to include war veterans in the acknowledgement of country, which is just fucking awful. And I think reflects exactly what you're saying is that maybe this war memorial shit isn't a super useful analogy. Because it conflates the kind of violence that we have and continue to do against First Nations with, like, the people who are going and doing that violence, like the army. What? Anyway,
yeah,
this
no,
is a bit
it,
of a side
it,
note.
But I do think it's an important point. But any of these kind of one-to-one cultural analogies are necessarily not going to... work properly. I understand
totally.
Your point that they're trying to find something that they can like they're hoping racists will relate to and be like, hey, I love the troops, don't respect
totally.
This troops thing. But so in the wake of this, a lot of the reporting has focused around the people who went there on the in the last days. High winds closed the climb for the first 3 hours of the last day of the climb, and everybody was kind of like laughing and chuckling, but that gave the media lots of opportunities to go and interview the people who were there lining up, being like, oh yeah, you know, it's on my bucket list, blah, blah, blah. A lot of focus on the motivation of these fucking assholes for why, like, essentially getting a national platform to explain why they've chosen to disrespect the traditional owners.
Yeah.
And rather than talking about those people and trying to understand their motivations or giving them the time of day, we just wanted to share a few reactions from Twitter and around the media from First Nations people. So the first off, I just wanted to read this quote, from The Guardian, which was, you know, their article about the climb closing. And the quote goes, "Watching the last of the climbers, the Anangu man Vince Forrester from Mutajulu said the discolored and damaged rock along the climbing route was like a scar that would not go away in his lifetime. Forrester said tourists using the top of the rock as a toilet had poisoned water holes and wildlife, and he was glad the climb would soon be over."
So disgusting. Yep, so this is a couple of tweets from Nayuka Gori, who says, "Uluru is a good example of why a lack of education is not the issue when it comes to race relations. We can share our stories, knowledges, and precious time with people, but when it comes down to it, a lot of people will choose themselves in a process informed by colonial values of possession, exploration, and entitlement." And there's a reply from that, a reply to that from Celeste Little, who says, "Yeah, and adding to the point, the fact that people with high-level uni qualifications have been quoted in the media talking about why they're climbing shows education is not a deterrent and may even lead to a higher level of racist entitlement."
There's a quote from the ABC's The Drum program from a local Indigenous ranger, Paul Radford, who said, "Now the climb is closed, we can focus more on the real things we want for people to experience as they come to the park." So I think that's, you know, one of the... it's nice to focus on what the positives coming out of this actually are. And it's like, okay, this is an opportunity not just for to stop people being disrespectful, but actually encourage people to come and meaningfully engage with local cultural traditions and customs and history.
This one's from Marcia Langton, who's an academic from Melbourne Uni, and she does a bunch of other stuff as well. She says, "A curse will fall on all of them. They will remember how they defiled this sacred place until they die, and history will record the contempt for Aboriginal culture."
Boom.
Yep.
And one last one from Scott Trindle, who at SCOTTRINDALL recommend giving them a follow on Twitter because he's very funny. He said, "What's that? Doing the Uluru climb is on your bucket list? Well, peeling shrimp, then punching a racist in the throat are on mine. And guess what, Bubba? We're all out of prawns." big up, Scott. Yeah, so we just wanted to bring you a few kind of reactions to that story that were not ours, because hopefully for obvious reasons. And yeah, if you you know, have thoughts or have seen any other good takes about that, hit us up on Twitter. You can find us at AusPolSnackPod. And now we've got
You fucked up.
So this has been a hilarious story that I've been following with glee all week about our energy our Minister for Energy and Emissions Reductions, Angus Taylor, who has been embarrassing in the news a number of times.
And not just embarrassing, but like corrupt.
Yeah, yeah.
Allegedly
corrupt. So this time he has gone on an attack against Clover Moore, who is the Lord Mayor of Sydney City, saying that her office spent $15 million on flights while they are trying to do some like hippie renewable energy shit, basically.
Yeah, Sydney City Council have announced that they're going to go 100% renewable. I can't remember what year they set as their target. But
right. It's like a completely reasonable like changing of the power generation, whatever.
Yes.
And Angus Taylor obviously cannot abide anyone actually doing anything to move towards a like safe climate.
Despite it being his literal portfolio.
No, I think you misunderstand. His portfolio is to prevent emissions reduction.
Oh, my bad.
Energy.
My bad.
And emissions reduction.
More energy, less emissions.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
So he had to go on a big fucking rant about how hypocritical Clover Moore is because they've spent $15 million of flights, and like, how could they possibly expect anyone to use renewable energy when they have flown places using fuel? And, I mean, it's just a shitty argument anyway.
He's such a fuckwit.
But the cherry on the top, well, I mean, the cherry at the center of this whole affair, is that they spent like $6,000 on flights. I don't have the exact number. $6,000. It was less than $10,000 in flights.
I'll bring it up, but keep talking.
Yeah. And he got this doctored document that has been edited to say $15 million instead of $6,000, whatever it is.
Well, you say got. We don't know where it came from.
Right.
He provided it to the Daily Telegraph, who then reported their story and was like, hey, look, this snapshot from the council's expenses shows that they spent $15 million or whatever it was. And the council was like,
that's not what our document said.
And in fact, here's a screen cap of the version that's on our website.
Yeah. And so it seems, and I must say, Angus Taylor has vehemently denied that he or his office was involved in this at all, but it seems like someone has edited that image to have a fake number on it.
And it like was done before
it got sent to the Telegraph
by Angus Taylor's office.
Yeah.
And it didn't happen at Sydney City Council as far as they can tell.
Yeah. So Angus Taylor originally, he was saying this is a conspiracy by Clover Moore to deliberately bait him into making this attack, which is just like,
if true,
it's fucking genius if it's true.
If true, fucking hats off.
That's some Thomas Carchetti level shenanigans there.
Deep cut wire references.
Yeah. So, you know, Clover, if you're listening and you did deliberately upload a fake document to get Angus Taylor to download it.
A, well done. B, you're welcome on the show anytime.
Absolutely. And it's just fucking hilarious. Anyway, Angus Taylor has been in a lot of hot water over this, and there's been like talk of reporting it to police about like falsifying documents and all sorts of other shit. And he has like very reluctantly half apologized in a really mealy-mouthed kind of way.
Yeah, he put out a statement saying that he was going to send a letter to Clover Moore apologizing, but completely
not actually
refused,
apologizing.
Yeah, and completely refused to acknowledge that his office might have had anything to do with the numbers being fabricated in the first place.
Totally.
Because he's a fucking walking embarrassment. This man is such a clown.
It occurs to me that this is very similar to the last sort of big media presence that he had, which was about a Facebook comment that he made on his own status where he had forgotten.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Great job. Well done, Angus.
He said, fantastic, great job, well done, Angus. But he had forgotten to log out of his own account and log in under his sock puppet account. So he had just commented on his own status, praising himself, which was, you know, fantastic.
Amazing.
Great job. Well done, Angus.
But definitely, probably the best Ozpol meme of the last year. If we were to do for
shitpost of the year.
Yeah, like a top 10 or whatever, which that's a great pin in that.
Totally. Maybe for Christmas. But this seems like almost exactly the same thing somehow. He has, like, downloaded something, he's faked it, and then he's sent it out, but he's accidentally managed to do it in a way that completely, incriminates himself.
Allegedly.
Yeah.
The reporting about this story is how, like, because of our extremely, like, draconian
defamation laws,
all the reporting has had to be, like, very explicitly, there is no suggestion that Angus Taylor or his office had anything to do with this, but also there is nowhere else that it could have possibly come from.
Yeah.
And you were right about that $6,000 figure, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
In comedy, that's called a callback. Moving on.
Is that what a callback is? I'm not sure. Let's move on. So, Zach, for our main course, what are we having? Can you tell us? What's on the menu?
Maybe I'll say, I'll say redacted and I'll beep it out.
Cool.
Redacted.
Nice. Oh,
Risnack. Okay. So earlier this week, the front pages of most of the newspapers across Australia published like a redacted story, where they had a bunch of the text blacked out. And a little really like poorly designed little graphic on it that said top secret, not for public release or something like that. But essentially, it's a protest against the way that the government and security agencies have been hassling, prosecuting, intimidating journalists. This is a freedom of the press thing. We've talked a little bit before on the show about this kind of general trend towards authoritarianism that the successive governments have taken, and particularly this government, not just against the media, but against whistleblowers and public servants
activists.
In general. Activists. But this particular issue, which has kind of culminated most recently in this press blackout stunt, I guess you'd call
campaign.
It. Campaign. It's kind of a long one and it goes back a little while. And so I thought rather than doing what we normally do and just give just our thoughts on it, I might do a bit of a like narrative overview of this case because it's been
stuff
a kind of
that's led up to this point.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Because I think it is a longer kind of complicated story and parts of it are really boring as well. So I'm going to do a little timeline starting from kind of the middle of this year and just describe how we got to this point. And if at any point it does start to get too boring, maybe just like, make like a funny noise or something and I'll try to like move on to the next section quickly.
Cool.
Wubba lubba dub dub.
Ka-ka!
Yeah, that's great. Nailing it. Okay. So this all kind of kicked off in June this year, the beginning of June, when the Australian Federal Police raided the home of Annika Smethurst, who is the national politics editor at News Corp, most notably for the Herald Sun. And they were saying, basically alleging that she had the accusation they were investigating for was communicating or allowing someone to have access to an official secret without authorization. So essentially, she got a leaked document and reported on it. So this was in reference to a story that Smethurst had published over a year prior to that investigation, which was about the heads of the Home Affairs Ministry and the Defence Ministry having a conversation about giving the Australian Signals Directorate, or ASD, powers to investigate Australian citizens, which they currently do not have. You know, we don't spy on our own. Most countries, you know, it's like spying on your own people, bit of a no-no.
Well, there are other agencies who do that, and the ASD currently doesn't, at least as a matter of course. They
yes.
need to have, like, quite extensive warrants and, like, needs to be requested from other agencies.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of part of the larger security apparatus. And just for a little bit of background for anybody who, like me, was not super clear on who the ASD are and what they do, essentially they're like the cyber unit of the intelligence community. So as separate from ASIO, who you might think of as more of your traditional spy agency along the lines of like MI5 or CIA or something like that, ASD is very much about intercepting digital communication and gaining intelligence that way. So there was a letter exchanged between the heads of those two departments, and that was leaked to Smethurst, and she reported on this, and everybody was like, this is fucked, this is extremely like surveillance state, we don't get down like that. And while I was doing a bit of research for this story, I actually read a story from over a year ago, which I just wondered, it's not super relevant, but I thought it was kind of funny, when Dutton was pushing for an expansion of the ASD's powers, and I just want to read this quote from him. Mr. Dutton said, any suggestion the proposal would pave the way for wholesale spying on Australian citizens was, quote, complete nonsense. That was reported by the ABC in 2018. And then, yeah.
Now all this shit has happened. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That letter got intercepted where they were like, so how about wholesale spying on Australian citizens?
Mm-hmm.
So that happened on the 4th of June. Smethurst's home got raided by the Australian Federal Police. One day later, the Australian Federal Police raided the offices of the ABC in Ultimo, in Sydney. And this was kind of a much bigger operation. They were in there all day. They commandeered documents, is that?
Yeah, so they basically sat down and at a computer and went through every single file on the ABC database. And their warrant said something like they can access, change, or delete any files that might be relevant to this story about the potential war crimes of Australian soldiers in Afghanistan.
Yes. So this was in reference to a story that had happened not a year ago, like Smethurst's story, but 2 years prior in 2017. called the Afghan Files. And so this was a reporting about, potential war crimes being committed by Australian elite special forces in Afghanistan, including the murder of unarmed women and children.
Mutilation of corpses.
Like a bunch of really, really fucked stuff that our defense forces are doing with or basically complete impunity.
Yeah.
Something that you might argue is in the public interest for us to know.
Mm-hmm. What's being... I might argue that. You're right.
Yeah. You might potentially argue that. So, yeah, bit of a coincidence that those two raids happened within a day of each other, but the stories were 1 and 2 years old, respectively. So you can imagine the Australian media community kind of got up in arms about this because it's just strategically such a bad move, I think, for them to have like done what are very obviously intimidating raids.
Yeah.
On the ABC and News Corp within a day of each other.
Totally. It's like driving enemies together.
Together. Yeah. And like the media landscape in this country is already so kind of polarized. The News Corp spends so much of its time attacking the ABC already. Like, why bite the hand that feeds?
Yeah.
Dutton and AFP and Australian intelligence agencies.
We give so much good advice to conservative politicians on this show.
For fucking free. Well, you know, $1 a month if you want to get the bonus episode, but whatever. So later that month, a couple weeks after these raids happened, these media enemies came together. The heads of the ABC, Channel 9, and or 9 Corporation, and News Corp came together and basically gave a press conference being like, this is garbage, stop intimidating us, we need press freedom, and basically had a list of demands. And I'll go into that a little bit later. So the response to this, in kind of the following weeks from the government, was that they announced the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, or PGCIS, or PUSIS, as I've decided to refer to it, it was going to have an inquiry on the impact of law enforcement and intelligence powers on media freedom. So government was like, we'll look into it. Yeah, we'll look into it. A Senate inquiry was also established. I was like trying to find out what the difference between the PUSIS and the Senate inquiries was going to be. And I went to the like Australian Parliament House website to look at the description of both inquiries, and the one on the Senate inquiry was like, this inquiry is very similar to the PUSIS inquiry. So fucking go figure. I guess it's slightly different people who are going to be, you know, it's senators and then the other inquiry, whatever. So essentially, yeah, the government's like, yeah, we're looking into it. So the next development in this story happened a couple months later, in September. The AFP raided the home of an intelligence officer called Cameron Gill. There's not a whole lot of information out there about this dude or about the raid, but you know, it happened in Canberra, and everybody was kind of assuming that. It looked very obviously like it was related to these other raids, and potentially specifically the Smethurst story. So that kind of kicks up the hornet's nest even further. Then towards the end of the month, Christian Porter, the Attorney General, basically orders prosecutors to ask him specifically before they go after any ABC or News Corp journos for potential...
national security related crimes or whatever.
And I just want to read you the response from News Corp that they put out after this happened. And also caveat, fuck you, News Corp. Quote, the direction issued by the Attorney General is unremarkable. They make the Commonwealth Department of Public Prosecution seek the Attorney General's consent to take legal action against journalists in a few more instances, but they offer no comfort for journalists disclosing information in the public interest that they are safe from prosecution for doing their job. This so-called safeguard falls a long way short of what media organizations are seeking, to recognize the role of journalists to keep the public informed. So, I mean, how often do you see News Corp come out swinging against the government, generally speaking, but specifically when it comes to issues of like national security?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And obviously this is happening in their own backyard, but like the government has really picked a bad fight here, I think, you know, to have like your main cheerleader turn around and be like, nah, fuck you. You get both middle fingers for this one. Anyway, the most kind of recent development about this that is kind of related, that's been in the news, is something that the PGCIS, PUSIS, has done, which is basically the intelligence community came to them proposing legislation for introducing facial recognition technology, similar to stuff that you're seeing happening in China now, where basically, you know, they'll have a database where they can...
It was pretty fucked up. It was like they would take all of the driver's license registries and all of the passport registries and create this big database and all this other shit. So it seems pretty extreme what they were asking for.
For sure. Yeah, well, they want to create a database where they can digitally tell automatically upon a camera seeing a person who it is and know exactly where they are. Very surveillance state-y type stuff. So the joint committee was like, sorry, this is actually, you can't do this. And it instructed them to go, you know, to use the media's term, back to the drawing board. Like, they were like, you need to completely redraft this from scratch.
Sorry, just to be clear, they were actually rejecting government legislation that was being proposed. It wasn't from the security agencies.
True.
And they said to the government, you need to go back and completely redraft these laws from the bottom up.
Yep. Yep. So that's kind of where we're up to now. And then the most recent thing is that the Fairfax papers,
Channel 9 papers. Fairfax. Yep.
Sorry, Channel 9, the old Fairfax mastheads now under Channel 9, and the News Corp papers and the Guardian all put out this redacted front page as a protest about the way the government has been cracking down on them. And so that's kind of where we're up to at the moment. That's how we got here. Go on.
Can I make a suggestion? It's pretty unrelated to this whole thing, but if you, the listener, haven't read Catch 22 by Joseph Heller, go get it and read like the first chapter, which is just like an extended redaction joke. It's really fucking funny. It's a great book, but in particular that chapter, and it's just like every time I look at a newspaper and see that little like
black bar.
Yeah, black bar. I think about it. I yearn for you tragically, R.O. Shipman, Chaplin. Anyway, that's fine. Sorry, this is not Ozpol related. Just a classic novel.
Extremely nerdy reference. The show is also not amazing. Wouldn't bother.
Yep.
So that brings us pretty much up to date. So where we're at is basically the media saying this is what they want. They want search warrants, like cop search warrants to like raid journos to be contestable before the raids are executed, which seems like pretty...
Makes sense, yeah.
Pretty fair, not to have to watch them turn out your underwear drawer and then be like,
maybe you shouldn't have already done that.
Excuse me. They want better protection for whistleblowers because, is the government going to give it to them? No, how about the opposite? They want a limitation on the number of documents that are being marked secret by various government bodies. And this one is something that Smethurst has talked a bit about. And she argues that often documents are being marked at the absolute highest level of top secret because they're embarrassing to like politicians or agencies or whatever, not because they're actually extremely pertinent to national security. So essentially the government and the security community is misusing these national security laws to just
save face.
And control the narrative about what they're doing, which is very much, you know, what the Afghan Files episode was all about as well. That stuff that is, I don't know the details particularly, but that didn't seem like a national security issue to me.
No.
It was, you know, about events that had happened years prior. But it makes the Australian Defence Force look really bad. And they want to review freedom of information laws, because basically they're completely...
very arbitrary and out of control and...
massively convoluted.
Expensive and inconsistent as well.
And it just takes fucking ages to get stuff if...
And it costs thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're asking for those to be overhauled, and they want an exemption for journalists from being prosecuted under national security laws. So basically, they're just asking for stuff that would ensure press freedom and ensure that we can report that they can report on what the government is doing, especially if it's really shady stuff. The terms of the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Securities Inquiry, or PUSIS, the terms of their inquiry basically don't address any of that stuff. So the terms of the inquiry, they want to find out from journalists what it's like being the subject of police or intelligence operations and how that affects their work.
Uh-huh.
So tell us how this makes you feel.
Mm-hmm.
They want to determine whether any changes can be made to legal procedures to rebalance press freedom and national security considerations. Uh-huh. So they're like, oh yeah, we'll have a look if it's possible to change legislation. Then they're going to do an assessment about whether or not journalists should be allowed to contest warrants at hearings. So, you know, that's kind of close to delivering.
One of the asks, yeah.
And they are going to evaluate the appropriateness of allowing police and intelligence services to access electronic data held by media organizations.
Yeesh. So,
yeah, should we be allowed to hack you? Access your stories like whenever we want? Good question.
I wonder what they will find.
So what this all seems to suggest is that the government has set up this inquiry or these two inquiries to essentially mark time and make it look like they're doing something. And anytime anybody kind of brings it up, they can be like, oh, we've got an inquiry about this. Don't even sweat it. And the inquiry is going to present its findings at the end of November. The Senate inquiry is going to present their findings, I think, in March. So we've got a pretty short time frame until we get some kind of formal response from the government on this. But basically, short answer, it's not looking good. The official line from ScoMo has been, no one's above the law, including journalists, which, of course, is not the fucking issue, Scott. The issue is the laws themselves.
It's also, shit laws. Like, I mean, some people... Like, there are laws that apply to different people differently. Like, for example, if you're not a doctor and you write a script for Valium or whatever, that's a fucking crime. But when you're a doctor, you're allowed to do it.
No one's above the law.
And
no one's above the law.
Maybe journalists might have a different role than the average citizen in terms of handling classified documents or whatever. Like, it's not about above the law, but there are laws that have different boundaries and shit. I don't know.
Can I say on behalf of the government, fuck you for trying to introduce nuance into this conversation, you accomplice.
So would you say that no one is above the law? Is that really the point that you would make?
This joke's getting a bit old.
Cool.
Noon. that's where we're at. Did you have anything else you wanted to say on that?
Yeah, my main thing, and like, I don't know if this is really fair to expect like a week after this whole campaign has come out, but it really seems like Scott and the government don't care in the slightest that this is going on. It seems like it's not going to make any difference and that it's probably just going to peter out when the editors get bored of having like crossed out stories in their ad space.
Well, I think, and it's something that we've discussed before on the show, that especially when it comes to these publications that usually support the government, like the News Corp papers, like actually addressing the root causes of this crackdown on press freedom and this move towards authoritarianism and like pretty fascistic policies is going to require like a massive change in the attitude of our government towards national security and their underlying fucking fundamental values, the way that they regard people who weren't born in this country, etc. Yeah. News Corp is never going to support that stuff. They are still extremely reactionary, conservative, right-wing their organization that is about solidifying and propping up state power. It just so happens that this is one very specific, like, nuanced example where like, the government and the security agencies are, like, shitting in their backyard.
Yep.
But any kind of meaningful response to this is going to have to... It's going to
run contrary to the News Corp philosophy and values.
For sure. And not just them, but the media in general, the way that they approach stories about information being repressed, the way that the government is cracking down on activists, etc. And we've talked about this, that like by the time they get to the press, it's too late. You need to be arguing for freedom of political expression and freedom of information.
When it's not media companies who are in the spotlight or in the firing line, yeah.
That's right. So, you know, I think that there's kind of a massive overhaul of this attitude required. And it's not just media, obviously. This has got to do with public perception as well. And these things are inherently interconnected. But my point is that I think a unilateral campaign that's just specifically about the way that this is affecting newspapers in particular is not nearly broad enough. I don't want to say that they shouldn't be doing this.
No, totally. It seems like it's worth a shot.
Yeah, absolutely. And look,
and like, is something I believe in and agree with
for sure. And I'm sure that they are raising the profile of this.
Mm.
And you know, we did note that the Pearsis had knocked back this facial recognition legislation from the government. I do wonder if they had done that if they weren't under the additional scrutiny that this media campaign has put
together.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah. We sort of didn't. We sort of glossed over that. But that facial recognition thing basically has nothing to do with the rest of this, except that it's also under the purview of the PJCIS, and that, yeah, it seems likely that this like wholesale facial recognition thing might have just gone through if everyone wasn't looking at the PJCIS at the moment.
Yeah, so I mean, I think it has kind of exposed, I guess, some of the groups, bodies, and mechanisms that deal with national security and press freedom legislation when it comes up, which is a positive thing. I think that's probably enough on that. We can move on. I just wanted to say before we move on that a lot of the info that I drew on for that little chunk came from reporting by Dennis Muller, who is an academic working at the University of Melbourne and has held several editorial positions at what used to be Fairfax Papers. So if you want to get a bit more detail about those stories, look into his work. He's been reporting on this consistently for The Conversation for the last couple of years. So shout out to D. Muller. Cool. All right. Now it's time for
Shitpost of the Week.
But it's been like 3 weeks since we had a Shitpost of the Week.
I'm out of breath. I need you to take this.
Yeah, cool. That's all good. So this
Yeah,
week,
3 weeks.
Yeah, since the Shitpost of the Week. And we're very happy because there was a lot of good shitposting this week. And one of the, you know, Zach always talks about the shitposts and the shitposts. So one of the real shitposts this week was from Michael Lunig. The other Lunig, you know, Mary Lunig being the one that we should all be paying attention to. But he did a cartoon that probably most of you have seen that's about a mum and her baby falls out of the pram because she's on the phone. And
what if phones but too much?
What if phones but too much? It's such a useful tag group. but this, yeah. So everyone was making fun of it. Mary Lunig did some cartoons about it. Someone did a great post that it was hilarious that was her on the phone while a toddler was like lying behind her on the sidewalk. It was just like a photo of her playing on the phone with like this toddler there. Anyway, it's been some good shit. But this one is a poem from Ginger Valentine, who's a member of the group and who I know IRL. So hey, Ginger, thanks for your contribution.
Like the Lunig cartoon had a poem in it as well.
It did,
which I've decided not to read.
Because
fuck that guy, but that's important.
Because Ginger wrote a poem.
And just to remind everybody, we love poem shit posts.
Yeah, because we can read them out on the podcast.
Way easier than describing a visual meme.
Anyway, so this is the poem / meme that Ginger Valentine wrote. It goes, Lunig was busy on Facebook again, recycling cliches he fished from the drain, forgetting that prams come with seatbelts and such, in favor of dull, what if phones, but too much. So,
nailed it, Ginger.
It was really good. Thank you. So that's our shit post of the week and our shit post of the week.
Nice and neat. One little shitty package. Cool. So before we wrap up this week, this is the section where we'd normally read out any new reviews we've gotten on iTunes. And up until now,
we have got one review which we will read.
A little bit later. But up until now, every review that we've received has been positive, and that is, you know,
lovely.
That's so lovely, and thank you so much to everybody who's left a review and everybody who's just in general been positive about the show. We appreciate it so much. But we did get a comment that was quite critical of last week's episode. So we thought in the interest of fairness, and because we had a few people talk to us about the episode and ask us some questions and kind of make some suggestions, that we should respond to this kind of more negative review as well.
So this was actually a comment on our post. This wasn't a review, but it felt important. And so I'm just going to read out part of it because it's quite long. So Kira's perspective felt underutilized. It was hard sitting through the chit-chat about memes at the start. In response to the positive review, you said you don't do that much research. People engaging with Australian politics deserve high-quality content, and this podcast seems to prioritize quantity over quality. If you're both white men accepting donations for a low-effort podcast that you aren't bringing presentation or interviewing skills to, I hope you're compensating Indigenous Australian guests for that time. Which, oof.
Ouch.
Pretty brutal. That, as I say, this was like half of the
comment. There's more, but we won't go into the whole thing. And look, for the most part, can't really be mad. We are very new to interviewing.
Neither of us have any kind of like formal journalism or interview training.
Nope.
And yeah, like we totally accept that we are not experienced interviewers and probably aren't making the best use of our guest time compared to like someone who's way more experienced at that.
Sure. And yeah, we're definitely still learning, and we're you know going to take a lot of lessons from from that last interview about you know stuff that we could be better at moving forward. And we do want to just emphasize again, thank you so much, Kira, for coming on the show.
Totally.
And,
it
was you know really great to talk to them, and it's a shame that people felt like their perspective was underutilized, to use the commenters' term. So you know, sorry about that.
Yeah, and look, I mean, there were some other bits of this comment that I think that we probably won't be able to completely take on. So, for example, the chit-chat about memes at the start, that's like half the point of the show.
It's in the DNA.
So we're going to do that.
Might not be the show for you in that case. In which, but also, fair enough.
Yeah.
And to address the specific thing about, you know, paying our guests, especially when it's First Nations people or people from marginalized communities, that is what we use like a majority of the Patreon money for at this point. So we do cover our costs like for hosting, for the like to actually host the podcast, and also as in web hosting for it, and also reimburse ourselves for the
equipment that we bought,
gear that we've spent money on. But yeah, we gave Kira a fee, and we hope to be able to offer that to people in the future.
Totally.
So if you are donating to the Patreon, that is where a majority of the money is going.
There was one other thing, which was about we said that we don't do that much research, and I think like on some level that's kind of true. Like we aren't going out hard-hitting journalism.
We're not journalists.
We're not doing deep original research or going and interviewing the people who are deeply involved in these stories. We're not digging through files, but we do read a lot about the stuff that we talk about. We try and get our numbers right. I think specifically I was saying that about like not having a number on hand and like whatever. Yeah. So,
we do also constantly undermine ourselves.
Yeah.
Which I've been told to stop doing so many times that I'm sorry, I just can't.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that comment was a little bit self-deprecating and we meant it not entirely seriously. But also, look, if you feel like you're not getting enough or the right type of info from us, then sorry that we're not meeting that. But we think a lot of people are enjoying the show and are getting a lot out of it because we are getting a lot of good feedback as well. So let us know what you think about the show, and we're totally open to receiving critical feedback.
Yeah, we actually do. We do appreciate it. And this comment was in some ways harsh, and I'm sure that this person isn't actually listening to the show anymore. But we will take lessons from this comment and from that episode, so we do appreciate it.
There was one other critical feedback item that we got about that interview, which is that someone felt like we had been really harsh about International Women's Day.
We discussed basically that some of the organizers had been known to be TERFs and SWERFs for the International Women's Day March, and that we'd kind of erased the work of a group of intersectional feminists and women of color who've been working hard to make that event more inclusive.
That's totally fair.
Strengthen its progressive political ethics. So we're sorry that we kind of gave them short shrift there. Again, you know, we always love to hear back about stuff like this. You know, we can't be up on everything. And lots of our listeners know more about specific things than we do, for sure. So,
which we haven't had any potluck submissions for a long time. But if you have strong thoughts about something that we have said that is wrong, or something that we haven't touched on enough, or whatever, you can record yourself talking for 1 minute and email it to us at ozpolsnackpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, or you can send it to us via the Facebook page now.
Totally.
As well.
Yeah, we can do it over Facebook messages.
Yeah,
yep.
Just send us a message. Cool. So to balance that out, we're going to read out one review on iTunes that we got this week that was positive. So this is a 5-star review from someone called Anne, titled Great Work, and says, refreshing take on politics. Being an oldie, I sometimes struggle to understand it, but it's wonderful to hear views from the left and expand one's mind with different views and concepts. I totally agree that views from the left are generally stodgy and boring, although I totally support them, and like being told to eat your greens as a kid. I love greens now, by the way.
Thanks, Anne. Snacking on those broccolis. The progressive
broccoli.
Extremely
sweet.
It was, yeah.
Extremely sweet review. So thank you, Anne. Thank you for everybody else who's given us feedback, whether it's critical or positive. We genuinely do appreciate getting it.
And thank you for all of our Patreon donors. If you like the show and want to support us and support our guests, you can hop on patreon.com/OzPolSnackPod. And for $1 per month, you get a bonus episode each month.
And you also get access to our private Discord server where you can chat directly to us if there's something that you want to ask about or talk about or suggestions, you know.
Totally.
So you can find us also on Facebook at OzPolSnackPod. You can find us on Twitter at OzPolSnackPod. And come and join the OzPol shitposting Facebook group if you're not already a part of it and you like what you hear and you want to see some of these memes. I reckon that probably wraps us up for the week.
Cool.
Keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.